This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Lynn Neary in Washington. Although it's only been the new year for just a few days, there are lots of resolutions that have already been made and a few that have already been broken, no doubt. According to a recent Marist poll, the most popular picks include resolving to get a better job in the coming year and to be a better person. Not surprisingly, more women picked the latter than the former. For many Americans, their job is who they are. It's not just something to make money. It's a commitment to one's identity, a place to meet like-minded people, do the right thing, even have fun. Or if it isn't, many people believe it should be. If you are looking to find a calling in your work, today's show is for you. What makes a job something that feels right? How important is it to have a job that's aligned with your values? If you're thinking of changing careers, how do you know what questions to ask yourself as you navigate through the waters of change? We're joined by author Poe Bronson. He wrote the book What Should I Do With My Life, and he's with us from the New York Bureau. Thanks for being with us, Poe.
Oh, thanks, Lynn. It's really a pleasure to be on.
Let me ask you, your previous books were somewhat related in that they covered the business world, but this one is far more philosophical. You've assembled around 50 stories of people who not only asked the question, what should I do with my life, they also answered it. What made you decide to take on a project like this?
It's tonally a very different book than the ironic, satirical books I'd covered, high finance and high technology. The television show I was writing for was canceled. This was about 3 years ago at exactly this time. I was out of work. I had a baby on the way, my first. And I was at that crossroads where I was wondering, how should I handle this situation? Should I just make money to support my family? Do I need to be there for my son? Or do my artistic aspirations still matter at crossroads like this? And I kind of saved my soul by trusting my instincts, and I craved to tell stories of people who had reinvented their life to embrace greater truth and meaning. As you mentioned, I recorded a lot of people's stories, and there's about 50 in the book. And
I think in the intro you said you talked to something like 900 people.
I was asking it a question, the right question at the right time. It was pregnant in our society as 9/11 and the burst economy and the change in the business climate made a lot of people suddenly searching for new ways to define what was meaningful about their life experience.
How did you go about finding all these people?
I wish that I knew the right way to do it. Like, I wish now you can put lists up on websites and you can call these websites and they'll put postings up. I just told people and the word spread. And next thing you know, the phone rang and it was a woman from Thailand who was in the middle of reinventing her life and wanted to talk to me when she got back to California. Or I got an email from someone who'd read about someone in their high school newsletter, an executive who'd become a cop in LA, and I had to track him down. It just kind of happened on a very grassroots method.
We're talking with writer Poe Bronson about his book, What Should I Do With My Life? If you'd like to join the conversation, our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK, and the email address is totn@npr.org. You know, Poe, you use the word calling a lot in this book to describe how people feel about their work, about their careers, about their jobs. Why do you choose that word? What does that mean, a calling?
It's a sense that what you do is in alignment with who you are and that you want to stick it out. You want to make a contribution there. You care about being there. I don't want to confuse it with this notion that there's some single perfect answer, because that's not what people found. They didn't find like the one thing that's best. They found something good enough. They learned to get what they love, and they also learned to love what they then got and accept events beyond their control. So it's something that you grow into over the course of a lifetime, not something you tend to know when you're young. And that's one of the myths, that those who have callings, they knew them when young. And there are some stories like that, but they're actually fairly rare. And most people sort of discover this, they unearth their true sort of psychological selves over the course of many experiences.
We should say this isn't really a self-help book. I mean, there's no 12-step program or 10-step program. This is a book of people's stories. Why did you choose to write the book in this way, this book of stories, really?
Honestly, I was artistically drawn to sort of transformation stories. I think because I wanted to go through that myself. And I thought they would make good artistic stories. I wanted to take this material and, if I could, elevate it towards literature, and in so doing, honor it and help people stop feeling guilty for taking this question seriously.
What are some of the questions that people should be asking themselves? Are there right and wrong questions, or better questions that a person should ask himself or herself if they're thinking of making a change?
Well, just a couple. One is this question people ask: should I save up some money? Should I wait until the economic times are better? I thought that would be true. It turns out that that's not when people change their life, that the vast majority change their life in hard times, when they were sort of forced to overcome the doubts that normally stopped them. So the people in the book have been laid off and bankrupted and suffered illnesses or the death of loved ones or divorced. And in a way, that hardship shaped their character and gave them a resolve they didn't have before. During good times, people tended to just continue to mop up the gravy train and not really make any changes. That's one question to ask yourself. Another one, important one, I think, is people are often asking, what's going to make me happy? And they can imagine a lot of scenarios that are going to make them happy. I didn't find that helped people find what they were looking for. The people who found it did so by asking, will it be fulfilling? Will I make a contribution? Will I be making an impact? Will it be meaningful? And I think that those are sort of more oriented towards the soul and less towards sort of the brain candy of what's intellectually fun.
Does happiness usually follow if they orient themselves more towards fulfillment?
Well, I guess I would say no, which is that happiness is a dog sunning itself on a rock. People want to lead interesting, compelling lives. Mm-hmm. I think we get over-fixated on the notion of happiness. A lot of people are in incredible struggles. They're working with important causes. They're encountering a lot of tough problems. It's very meaningful, soul-fulfilling work. That doesn't necessarily mean that they're happy or that life is fun all the time, and I don't think that's what people should be looking for or asking of themselves as a sort of test. They should be looking for something deeper within.
We're talking to Poe Bronson about true callings and changing one's career and perhaps finding a true calling. The number is 1-800-989-8255. Let's go to Chris in Plymouth, Minnesota. Chris?
Hi. I just graduated from seminary at age 43. I went back to school part-time at age 37 when my kids were 3, 5, and 7, and it's been the first time in my life that I can't believe I get paid to do what I do. I was listening to your guest, and it isn't about being happy. It really is about finding incredible meaning in what I do, and I just pinch myself every day. I was installed as an associate pastor in September, and, of course, in the religious community, we talk about call as relates to vocation all the time. And more, as I've gone through this process myself, I've come to understand this as something that I wish more people could experience, what it means to get up and do work that is fulfilling. And obviously, some people just have bread on the table, and it's not always an option. But, boy, I can't recommend it to people enough.
Let me ask you something, Chris. You said you went back to the seminary at 37. Mm-hmm. We heard Poe say a lot of times people make life changes when they're going through a difficult time. What sort of motivated you to move in that direction?
There wasn't any. My life was actually great. I was a full-time at-home mom. I had been in the insurance industry for 11 years and at home for almost 4. And I loved that. I'd still go back to that in a minute. But for me, there was a triggering event when my dad had heart surgery, which was fine. It turned out fine, but the chaplain at the hospital was kind of terrible. And I can be pretty critical, and I thought, well, I could do that person's job better than they do. And in the end, realized that actually I felt I could do that job and felt I was being called to that job. And I had never worked at a job where I felt it was my calling. I always felt like I was kind of trying to do the corporate thing was fine. I was, you know, reasonably successful, but it never felt like a fit. And this time I finally felt like what I was gifted to do, what gave me energy, what I could do most naturally, fit the vocation I was being called to. And that's something that's occurred to me more and more. Things don't have to be difficult to be good and to be important. Sometimes what we're best at comes most easily. and what is where we should be spending our energy. And for me, that was kind of the transition point, realizing it didn't have to be hard in order for it to matter.
All right. Thanks so much for your call, Chris.
You're welcome.
And now I'd like to bring in Warren Brown into the discussion. He is one of the people that you interviewed, Poe, and one of the characters, if we want to put it that way, in your book. He's the owner of Cake Love and the Love Cafe. He's a former staff attorney for the Department of Health and Human Services. Welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Thank you, Lynn.
Warren, your decision to become an entrepreneur, was it a long process? Did you have a moment where you just said, aha, this is it, I've got to do this now?
It was a little bit of a long, drawn-out process over, it depends on how far you want to go back. I've always wanted to be in the food industry and cook, and I took an interest in cooking back in college, but I suppressed those desires a lot and didn't act on it. I didn't think that after graduating from college that it would be appropriate for me to go into the food industry, and, you know, who knows why. I just had all kinds of ideas in my head of maybe what I should be doing with my life. And after graduating from law school and practicing law, I just realized that I'm not happy. I'm still coming home from work and making food that's elaborate and beyond the, you know, beyond what's reasonable, I think, for making a meal for oneself. And I was always looking for a viable way to get into the food industry. And at this point, after graduating from graduate school, I did not want to go back to school to learn.
Where were you working at that point? What were you doing?
I was working at the Health and Human Services as an attorney then. This is in 1998, 99, in D.C.
And just doing your cooking for yourself?
Yeah. I mean, you know, I'd come home and make dinner and spend about an hour, hour and a half sometimes doing it just because I enjoy working with ingredients and herbs and spices and, you know, methods of production. It just thrilled me, really.
All right, so then take us up to where you are now. Now you're baking cakes for a living.
Yeah, cakes from scratch at Cake Love, and it's a lot of fun. We make cake at Cake Love, and we sell slices of cake and small things, cupcakes and different types of small cakes at the cafe, which is directly across the street from the bakery. And my main job now is managing both of the establishments. I do some baking, I do some assembly. But, you know, there's about 10 to 15 people in each location that I have to spend time managing and hearing from them what's going on. And
do you feel like you've found your true calling?
I do. I think that a lot of what my calling is about is creating different types of fun food for people to share and enjoy. And in this situation, for very special occasions, I think that it's a good fit for me, too, in doing the personnel management because, you know, people come to me with all types of different requests and needs. And from what I've heard from those that work for me, that I've been fair and honest, you know, about helping them out. And I enjoy doing that. It's funny that I didn't think that, I guess I kind of overlooked how much of a position I would be in, how it would be different than just making cake as an entrepreneur. I mean, there's so many different things that a business owner has to do, some of which I was aware of before I began the business, but many I've just kind of found and learned along the way because it's not really written down any place about how to run a business.
Well, thanks so much for talking to us today, Warren.
Sure.
Warren Brown is the owner of Cake Love and the Love Cafe. He's a former staff attorney for the Department of Health and Human Services. He joined us from his office in Washington, D.C. We are talking to Poe Bronson about his book, What Should I Do With My Life?, and about finding a true calling. And we're taking your calls at 800-989-TALK. You can send us an email to totn@npr.org. I'm Lynn Neary. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Lynn Neary in Washington. We're talking about what it takes to find a calling in life and why just asking the question, What Should I Do With My Life Can Have Profound Consequences. Our guest is Poe Bronson, and he joins us from our bureau in New York. You're invited to join the discussion. Give us a call at 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. Poe, we've been talking about the fact that often when people do, in fact, ask the right questions, perhaps take a bit of a risk and find their true calling, they do find fulfillment rather than happiness. But is there also a downside? I mean, do you necessarily make yourself feel fulfilled by following your dream?
No, and I think we should have some people from the book later on in this hour who didn't get it that way. In fact, include in the story of the book one woman, Wendy Jones, who found fulfillment when she finally stopped chasing that dream she'd always been chasing. A lot of people forget to pay attention to real life and in a fruitless search for a dream. So I'm interested in this sort of maturing, this sort of negotiation between aspiration and responsibility as we narrow in on somewhere that we feel right. The people in the book didn't abandon their responsibilities. They learned that their responsibilities are part of their purpose, often the most important part.
All right, let's take a call from Anthony in Syracuse, New York. Hi, Anthony. Go ahead.
Hi. How are you all today?
Good, thanks.
I wanted to make a comment and ask a question related about the finding the meaning in the meantime. I'm 46, and I'm going back to getting a master's in elementary ed. And I graduated with high honors in 79 from a, you know, famous school and everything, and proceeded then to get dead-end jobs for the next 20 years. And there were certain reasons and things that contributed to that, but it was really kind of horrible. But the thing is, he's talking about the maturing thing. In the meantime, I had to, one of the good things that came out of all that was I had to face every day and find out what were the important things, even in this negativity that I was in, or even in this place where it didn't fit. And for me, it had to do with paying attention to people and my having high-quality interactions and making them count. And so I take that, and I'm really excited about going into teaching, but at the same time, I'm equipped to handle a lot of the negative stuff that is just going to be there, that some of the younger people going in aren't really going to be surprised by it. But the thing is, to be able to equip with both the dream and the sense of calling, and at the same time, knowing what to do with the stuff that you have at every job and the negativity and the disappointments and the things you can't control, learning how to handle that is really been an exciting thing for me. So I'm glad that I have that.
Poe?
Yeah, Lynn, you said as we came back from the break, what does it take to find your calling? And I think that our caller here is describing it's a journey in which you really do have to mature through a lot of personal transformation in order to embrace it and make the most of a good situation. And so people would say to me, oh, I changed my life overnight, and they tended not to be. It really took 5 years. And they would say that was sort of like a storytelling convention, the self-made person, that we're accustomed to telling our stories that way. And I wanted to sort of remap the way we tell our stories to admit our ghosts, our luck, our pain, and see that those, in fact, transform your character, and a transformed character is maybe not just what will get you to success, but might be the whole point of it all after all, that callings are really a vehicle to round out who you are and make you a better person, not the other way around.
Also, the thing you said about the quick stories, like a lot of times you'll hear on the talk shows on TV, well, you know, you can do anything you want. And my wife and I would struggle with that. It's like, you can't do anything you want when you're discouraged or you're working a low-paying job. And you can't just drop everything. You have to come to the place where you're able to take XYZ risk. You're willing to take that risk. You know what's involved. And that's not an overnight thing. And I really appreciate, I wish I could hear a lot more of the behind the scenes. What did it take to get from point A to point B? That would be very encouraging for a lot of people.
Thanks so much for your call, Anthony.
Thanks.
You know, it's interesting, Poe, too. Earlier, one of the first callers was a woman who had gone back to the seminary, and she was talking about the fact that a religious calling is called a vocation, but that's not a way that people really think about work, usually, I think, in our society, do they, as a vocation?
One of the questions I was asking while I was doing my research was, calling was originally a religious thing. Did we need, is in fact this a symptom of people not practicing their religion carefully enough anymore, that they might call themselves Catholics or but not go to churches regularly? I found the opposite to be true. I found that from people from all sorts of religions, their religion was telling them that this is important, that to do God's work is important to find your calling, and then you will be doing God's work. Mm-hmm. And I was surprised. I was kind of educated to how many pastors and ministers are working with their congregation one by one in Sunday Bible class on career advice. Because people are struggling with these choices. And my book was a sign for a lot of Bible study. I was surprised.
All right, let's read an email. This is from Bethany in Portland, Oregon. Very interesting topic. My comment is that a lot of the fulfilling and rewarding jobs, in my opinion anyway, are pretty low paying. For example, jobs in education, environment, social work, etc., can be so soul-filling, yet are undervalued financially in our society. I wonder if that doesn't contribute to many people's ability to jump to that new job calling.
Certainly that's true. And the people in the book, a lot of them, learned, sometimes the hard way, to trade some financial income for psychic income. And sometimes that was a tough negotiation with their spouses and their family to understand that. There are other people in the book, though, who learned that, yes, business can be lucrative, but kind of like Warren Brown, business is really a tool to support what you believe in. And you can be in the business world and be making a positive impact.
If you'd like to join our discussion, the number is 1-800-989-8255. And joining us now from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, is Carl Kurlander, a visiting professor at the University of Pittsburgh. He left Hollywood, California a couple of years ago. He used to be a screenwriter and wrote St. Elmo's Fire, as well as a number of television programs like Saved by the Bell. Carl, welcome.
Well, thank you, Lynn, and Poe.
Carl,
hi, Carl.
When Poe Bronson profiled you in the hardback edition of his book, What Should I Do With My Life, you had just moved to Pittsburgh, where you grew up. Why did you decide to move back to your hometown?
It was a strange collection of serendipity, which I'd always fantasized when I went back to my old prep school in Pittsburgh of coming back and teaching, but we never had done anything about it, and I sent money back to my old prep school. And right around that time, somebody had left the school, and the woman, my credit card had gotten stolen, so she called. He started emailing me, and one thing led to another, and suddenly she said, you know, there's a teaching job here, and there was an impending writer's strike in Hollywood. And so it was like an opportunity which came out of the blue, and I joked with my wife. We were living above Sunset Boulevard with neighbors like Richard Simmons and David Schwimmer, and my wife, we have a four-year-old daughter, and my wife wasn't in love with living in that neighborhood. There were no play dates, strangely. So she kind of seized the opportunity and said, you should do this, and it kind of had its own momentum.
Now, you said you were afraid of losing your authenticity. Do you think you found a more authentic voice in your writing by returning to Pittsburgh?
Yeah, I wasn't afraid of losing my authenticity. I was afraid that I had lost my authenticity. I was driving above... You know, I'd come to Hollywood on a short story I'd written about people from Pittsburgh called St. Elmo's Fire, which a lot of my friends and people in Pittsburgh were in pieces of that in the movie. And I'd started to make a lot of money in Hollywood, but not writing from my heart. And it's no wonder I kept on meeting other people who, you know, you see so many movies about screenwriters waiting for their agent to call, and that's because that's what the experience is. And so in coming back here, it's been much more... much easier to get in touch with, I think, my voice as a writer. And even my agent, the first time I wrote my Christmas letter saying that when I had come back here, his wife said to me, that was the best thing I'd read all year. That way you should write more like that. And it's been quite the journey.
Now, you and Poe have not talked in a while, and some interesting things have happened to you since the two of you last spoke. So why don't you fill him in on what's happening in your life now?
Well, I'll try to do this in a short thing. It's the most insane thing that's ever occurred. As I was back here, I started to invite friends who I knew from L.A. There was one friend from Pittsburgh who was the head of Village Roadshow that did The Matrix. And he came back, and then the manager of Jim Carrey came back. It turns out he was from Pittsburgh, too. And people kept coming up to me, mostly the mothers, and saying, my son's from Pittsburgh, and my son's. It turns out that half of Hollywood is from Pittsburgh. In fact, my old the office that I teach in was the father of Rob Marshall, who directed Chicago, who grew up in Pittsburgh and loves Pittsburgh. And strangely, we the head of the film department, Lucy Fisher, half-jokingly said we should have the mothers to lunch. We had all their mothers to lunch at Pitt's film department. And what happened, like a miracle, in October, all these incredibly big Hollywood heavyweights came back to Pittsburgh and something called the Steeltown Entertainment Project to try to kickstart Pittsburgh. You know, they've lost a lot of young people here in Pittsburgh. On Friday, NPR just did a story on the fact that the city's financially distressed and that they've lost so many of their young people. And so now these people have all kind of joined together in this kind of Woodstock. They're all coming back to Pittsburgh to kind of mentor students and do kind of a Sundance type of workshops.
This sounds like a true calling to me, Carl.
Well, it's taken over my life. I mean, I think of Poe every day because he says, write your stories, and I am writing my stories. But I've also written an enormous amount of stories about each individual of these people. I've been profiling them for local magazines about their roots back in Pittsburgh. And it turns out that it wasn't just me. I was beaten up in junior high by a girl named, her last name was Soderbergh. Well, it turns out that her brother, which I had no idea, was a guy named Steven Soderbergh. So
the director. Yes.
Who knew? Back then, he was the
director of traffic
and who wouldn't play street football. Apparently, he, like me, was fairly shy about going out in the streets and playing street football. And his father actually taught film at Pitt and then left to go to Louisiana. So this movie, this has been the most extraordinary story of my life. This last year has been, and in fact, I say to my wife, because I keep going, you know, Pittsburgh's in financial distress, and was this a good move ultimately? And she goes, you know, this is bigger than any of us. So,
well, thanks so much for joining us today, Carl.
Well, sure, and say, Poe, thanks for changing everyone's life.
Thanks, Carl. Don't bring too much of Hollywood to Pittsburgh.
I know. I'm a little worried about that, frankly. Thanks for touching base.
All right.
Take care.
Thanks very much, Carl.
Bye.
Carl Kurlander is a visiting professor at the University of Pittsburgh. He left Hollywood a couple of years ago, and he used to be a screenwriter, and he wrote St. Elmo's Fire, as well as many television programs like Saved by the Bell. And as you just heard, he now lives in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, where we talked to him today. Let's take a call now. We're going to go to Robin in Denver, Colorado. Hi, Robin.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
Good.
Hi, Robin.
Hi. Thanks so much for this show. It's been such an important part of... I've been looking forward to it.
Go ahead.
Well, basically, I quit a very successful job about 3 years ago and went back to do prerequisite work for vet school. And I've now made my application, and the competition's real tough, and I'm a little nervous about my ability to actually become admitted to the vet school. And so I'm a little, you know, I'm kind of struggling with this idea that I may possibly not get in, and then where will I go from here? So it's kind of, I made a big decision and kind of changed my whole life, and if I don't get in, what am I going to do with this degree I'll have?
Poe, before you make that answer, I just want to remind our listeners that you are listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
Robin, are you still on the line?
Yes.
How did you make the decision? Had you had a lot of experience with veterinary medicine at all or with animals? Or did you kind of make this out of the blue, constructing a sort of sense that it might be right without any actual experience?
Actually, I have a ton of experience with animals, some experience with actual veterinarians as far as actually working with them, not a ton of that when I made the decision. But it's something that I wanted to do since I was 12 years old, and I just had an illness that kind of made me decide, you know, I may as well give it a shot and see what happens. So I guess
what I found for how people, because many people suffered many setbacks on the way towards finding a workable solution, and it seemed to work out best when they saw many paths. We often fantasize about the book's becoming bestsellers overnight. You know, Carl would get the movie deal. Warren's Bakery would become huge, and you'd be the great veterinary medicine doctor. But the truth is most of us take the slow road, and we have to envision multiple paths to the same destination and to remember that, you know, caring for animals is where the soul is going to come from there. And you can do that as a vet. You can also do that from, you know, working at the SPCA and finding other paths to the same destination.
And I appreciate that. I'm actually kind of just evaluating where it will take me in terms of other options, in terms of science and working with animals. It's just a little bit frustrating because I do have the desire and the ability. I just, there's just so much competition out there that, you know, it's a select few people, and most of the people that are doing the prerequisite work aren't working a job and having a family and a house and those types of things.
But it still could happen, couldn't it, Robin?
Well, it certainly
don't give
could,
up too soon.
I don't mean to say that. I mean, you know, I know I sound very negative about it. It definitely still could happen, but I'm definitely a thick ahead of the situation, and I really don't know where I would go from here if it didn't work out.
All right. Well, thanks so much for your call, Robin.
Thank you.
Poe, did you want to just add something?
Yeah, you know, just my little brother, nod out to him. After having five different jobs throughout his 20s and his 30s, decided to go back to medical school, and he didn't get in. He is a great, great nurse, and that is where he belongs. Hmm. And he's on a transplant ward in Seattle, University of Washington. He's tremendous. And I think that there is, and I think it's important to incorporate your experience and feedback from the world to find a workable solution. And so I wish Robin the best.
All right. I want to read this email to you from Peggy in Boulder, Colorado. I'd like to know the average age of the people who were interviewed for this book. Were the job changes associated with midlife crisis changes?
I interviewed people from their 20s to their 70s.
Hmm.
Because I'm 39. And I wanted to try to tell my generation's story a little bit. So the book is skewed a little bit in the middle of that bell curve towards people in their 30s and 40s. But I found as many retirees using this book as they were suddenly trying to think about what was important to their life, second-guessing their decisions, as I did new graduates from colleges and stuff. So wide diversity of people still care about these decisions.
All right, we're talking with Poe Bronson. He's the author of What Should I Do With My Life? And we're talking about asking yourself the hard questions about what you should do with your life. And since we're not your parents, there's no pressure, so give us a call. 1-800-989-TALK. That's 1-800-989-8255. I'm Lynn Neary, and this is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Right now on Talk of the Nation, we are talking with Poe Bronson, the author of What Should I Do With My Life? And joining us now is Nicole Heinrich. She's the president of Toner Lab. That's an office supply company in Chicago. Thanks for being with us, Nicole.
Thank you, Lynn.
Now, you contacted Poe to tell him your story. Is that right? Why did you do that?
That's correct. Actually, I found Poe's website by accident. And I think the reason I was looking for it in the first place was because I had lots of unanswered questions in my life, and I was generally dissatisfied. I felt lost in general and empty. And anyway, I came across Poe's site, and I noticed he was writing a book called What Should I Do With My Life? And I hoped that perhaps he had some answers for me, because I definitely didn't have any at that time.
And why not? What was happening in your life?
Well, I had been, I started a business with a guy who I was in relationship with previously, and I had a history of doing this, of creating businesses with the men that I had also dated. And what I would do is I would choose men to be my savior, so to speak, and that meant that they would make all my decisions for me. They would then be in the limelight. I would do all the work behind the scenes, but never really get credit for it. And I just felt a general dissatisfaction with my life, because I wasn't really making choices in my life. I was letting these savior figures make choices for me. And that led ultimately to a huge degree of dissatisfaction.
Did you end up changing your job?
No, actually, I stayed. This one job that I'm talking about here was relatively recent, with Tabin Corporation, and I stayed at that job for about 6 years.
What ultimately happened? We have just a couple of minutes left.
Sure.
I'm sorry, but just what ultimately happened? How did you change your life?
Ultimately, what happened was I resigned from Taven Corporation and started my own company, Toner Lab, doing the same thing, but there was a definite shift in my thinking and in the way that I felt as a person, and I finally took responsibility for my life and did it on my own.
And let me just ask you, what was the important question you asked yourself or the important insight that you finally had to lead you to where you are now?
Well, ultimately what happened was I realized that in all of my failed relationships and in all of the hardships and predicaments that I was in, the common denominator was me. So I took responsibility to finally make choices and decisions on my own and get rid of all my saviors in my life.
All right. Well, thanks so much for joining us today, Nicole.
You're welcome.
Nicole Heinrich is the president of Toner Lab. That's an office supply company in Chicago. Let me just ask you, Poe, coming off of that story, it's not always changing a job that's going to lead to that fulfillment we've been talking about. It's an internal thing, I guess.
Yeah, the people in the book, they matured psychologically as much as changed their environments on the outside. In Nicole's case, the Toner Queen of Chicago, she's still doing toner. It's just with a different attitude. And there's several stories in the book of people who went back to the corporate life after a period of introspection, trying to work within their companies, or realizing that they just needed a better life outside of work in order to have a more fulfilling, rounded-out experience. And there's also some stories of people in the book who do have day jobs, but good day jobs that allow them to indulge their hobbies outside of work.
And just one last question, Poe. Your book is called What Should I Do With My Life? Why is that word should important?
Because I felt that particularly my generation walks around a lot of times asking, what can I do with my life? That they feel a lot of possibilities and they want limitless possibilities. They want that feeling of there's so much potential, and they're averse towards making choices and sticking with them and working them out. And I wanted the moral imperative of should, not your parents telling you you should do this, not society telling you you should do this, but in your kind of in your heart or in your sense of what you're going to do while you're here, what should you do to raise the level to that sort of moral realm.
Well, thanks so much for joining us today, Poe.
Thank you, Lynn. I really appreciate it.
Poe Bronson is the author of What Should I Do With My Life? He joined us from our bureau in New York.